Et alors?
Et j'écoute Melting Pod avec Annie de Marseille.
J'écoute quoi?
Melting Pod, c'est le nom de... de moi en plus. Avec Annie de Marseille que j'adore.
Avec Annie de Marseille que j'adore. Salut, c'est Nonstop, j'écoute Melting Pod avec Annie de Marseille.
Que j'adore.
All right, Annie, this one's for you.
But you must repeat again the last sentence now because this is too weak. What you say about the Melting Pot Radio?
I said melting. You're listening to Melting Pot Radio, the most rockin' podcast in the world.
Yeah.
That works, right?
Yes. Very, very nice. The only problem is you are a little far away when I say.
Now I'm too far?
You are too far away in Los Angeles.
Oh, exactly. Well, you know, I'll take the next plane out and
yes.
Come see you tonight. I'll do a little private performance. You know what I'm saying?
Bonjour, welcome to Melting Pod, Sound and Colors from the Planet Marseille. Today, October 16th, we are with Steve Taylis, a musician from Perth, Western Australia. And you are listening to Alexander Monkey, a song from his album Zombie Party. Steve plays every time with different musicians without rehearsal, records, first take. On that album, you have on tenor sax Jamie Ollers, on the drums Ivan Stickman Jenkins, on the bass Colin Atkins.
Well, undervalue. If a knowledge derived from experience imposes patterns and falsifies. Not to the monkey, monkey time. Alexander knew just what it was talking about. Monkey, let's talk about
in today's episode, I want to introduce to you my new friend's musician from Perth, Western Australia, who found me on myspace.com/meltingpod, my other website where I promote my show and where the bands promote their music. The first one, John McNair, a musician from Perth, wrote to me among a million people who have a MySpace page. It was a strange coincidence, and very quickly our connection was very strong. Then Food John, Steve Taylor wrote to me, and then David Minder. I play his music at the end of the show. But in the middle, I want to give you a so long-awaited interview with Busby Strap from the Angels, recorded in March 2006, sorry for the delay. And right now, another song from Steve Taylor's Hard to Find. Heard a lot about Australia on Melting Pod, which was devoted at the beginning for the rock bands who play in Marseille, but it's more than a year, 1 year and a half, I created this MySpace page, and every day I got a lot of proposals from musicians around the world who asked to me to promote their music, and I hesitated a lot, but I found that too stupid to refuse them to be known in France and to be known by you, my faithful listener, and they are too good.
Well, it's carrying me away.
Good afternoon, Bobby Borderwise.
Yeah, good afternoon. Connect me, please, with the room 20.
I sure can. Just hold the line for me.
Hello?
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. You sound like you're next door.
Yes, that's why I can stop to speak with you, because I have the feeling you are with me and then you are in Australia again.
Yes.
And what happened during this last 3 months?
Gee, a lot has been happening for me in the last 3 months. Okay, in the last 3 months, I have been very, very busy. As you know, Annie, I've set up, with some other people, set up the Jimmy Little Foundation.
Yes.
Which is raising money. We are raising money to help the Indigenous people of Australia get better health and better education, particularly to teach the younger people that they are 30 times more likely than a white Australian to get kidney disease. So kidney disease is a very, very... Kidney disease and diabetes are two diseases which are really out of control in the Australian Indigenous population. And
Jimmy Little can you explain me why kidney disease? Because I don't understand why this...
Why Jimmy did this?
Yes.
Well, Jimmy Little, if people look up www.jimmylittle.com.au, they can see that, they'll see from Jimmy's history that he has spent nearly 50 years entertaining people in Australia. He was Australia's first Indigenous pop star in 1963. So he has a recognition and a name in Australia that he is prepared to use, you know, use his name and his reputation to raise money for this work in Indigenous health and education. So that's why we're using his name.
Yes, but I don't understand why the Aborigines are here with kidney disease specially.
Why are they?
Why because, is this illness?
Yeah, why the illness? Really, because they are genetically disposed to kidney disease through the sort of foods that they eat, which are Western processed foods like flour and sugar. The most popular drink, apart from alcohol, which not all Aboriginal communities are free of alcohol, most of them are. But the drink that really does the damage is like Coke and Fanta, that's really high in sugar, and that combined with maybe a diet that doesn't include the sort of foods that Aboriginal people used to eat, which were like, you know, hunting, you know, the kangaroos and lizards and fish and other root vegetables and things that maybe they don't eat now. So that's why they're predisposed to it. And a lot of the problems that they have are that because they're so remote, Australia is a huge place, and these communities are so remote that when somebody gets kidney disease, they have to fly them about 400 kilometres to a place like Alice Springs or Adelaide or Darwin, and they have to leave their family to go to these places to dialyse. And of course, as soon as they leave the family unit breaks down, and the kids kind of run amok and get into all sorts of drugs and sniffing petrol and stuff. And, you know, the simple explanation really is to build a dialysis room at the community. But, you know, unfortunately, the government's policy really is more about trying to set up the renal units in big centres, you know, and take people to them. But it's not...
I have a question.
Sorry?
I don't understand why... I think maybe the people already try that, but why they don't try to educate the people to eat differently? Or...
Well, that's exactly what we're going to be involved in.
Ah.
Yep, that's part of what we're being involved in. And, you know, you know, modern communications and internet and everything, it's the kids out in remote communities who should be getting the message about eating good food are watching the same advertisements and getting the same cultural input as kids everywhere. And if you have a look at white kids, I mean, a lot of white kids haven't got a particularly good diet either. Australia has got one of the highest rates of obese white kids in Australia, in the world, you know. So it's an education program that's got to go to everybody, really.
You want to tell me that the government didn't take care about the education of the Aborigine in particular, and it's not very
effective?
The
government?
Yes.
Did he say? Yeah. Well, look, there have been some things which have improved, you know, as far as governments go. A lot of people, I think, in the 70s and in the 80s, there was a lot of money that went out into Aboriginal programs that maybe wasn't put to the best use, and I think the government in particular was under a lot of pressure to make sure that whatever they spend, you know, out there is going to be, I guess they'd be made accountable for it. The government really has been in power for 10 years here, and you know, sort of the Aboriginal health issue isn't really a big one as far as you know, their agenda. It's not really high on their agenda. That's why we've got to help raise some money to do some of these programs that, you know, we know that the programs that we're talking about are worth doing because we're hooked up with renal doctors and a whole network of health workers around Australia. We've been talking to them and getting been made part of their research into what's needed and what is the best practice, what's the best thing to do. The stuff that we will be able to provide will be a good way of stopping the problem now, because I mean, what's happening now is that an Aboriginal man is getting ready to die when he's about 52 or 53 years old. That's the average age of...
Oh, yes. But what is your way to work?
The way to work? We're gonna do it by holding concerts and recording DVDs and other kind of music television programs. We're going to work on making those sort of programs, and from there we get obviously, you know, publicity, and we get sponsors to advertise when we're putting these programs on.
But you play, you organize a concert?
Do I organize it?
I want to know if you play a concert with the Angels, for example. No?
I would dearly love to do some songs there with our band and Doc, and it's something which I'd love to happen. But yeah, I mean, if not, I'm sure the Original Angels band will play there.
Yes, and you try to have Doc with the Angels?
Oh, I'd love to do that. It's just something that I haven't thought about just yet, and I'm going to work on that.
Yes.
Maybe yeah. So. Well, I'm going to speak to. Hey?
You are working about this project for Uluru or in
Well, I'm talking. I'm talking. Yeah, that there's a concert. Well, the first thing will be like a television show that we do in September.
Yes.
And that will launch, and then next year I'm going to have a big concert. That will be actually they'll be around Australia, probably July or August next year. And that's one that I'd love to get the Angels to play again.
Alison, a song from John McNair and his album Tears for Lucifer.
Sorry.
And I want to hear about you as a little child. I want to know, when did you start to play drums?
Yeah, that was 8 or 9 years old at the school. They used to have a little marching band, drum and fife band. And I started playing the drum there. Up until then, I had two older brothers who, one played a little drum kit and one played guitar. And I used to sometimes, up until I was about 9, I think, I used to play the other guitar and sort of play bass. And the three of us would play songs, play old 50s rock songs that my brother used to listen to because he was 16. He's 8 years older than me, so he was listening to Buddy Holly and, you know, Elvis Presley and all sorts of stuff from that era when I was about 8 years old. So, yeah, and then I started playing the drum at school, and then when I was 10 or 11, I would have seen Hard Day's Night, which is the Beatles film, and they had another film that was on with it that had about 10 other bands from the time, like the Hollies and the Mersey Beats and all of these people, and Dave Clark Five. And I remember that as being a pretty much a turning point from coming out of that film and knowing that I wanted to play drums and not necessarily guitar or piano. I used to muck around on the piano at home, but I didn't take any lessons till I was about 13. But yeah, I knew I wanted to play drums about 10 years old, I reckon, 10 or 11.
And when did you start to play really a concert or many concerts?
The first band I was in, I was 13, and we used to play at the school or the youth club. They had a church, you know, youth group, and we'd play at that. So that was when I was 13. When I was 14, I joined a band that one brother was 8 years older, the other one was 4 years older, and he was going to university when he was 18 and I was 14. And one of the guys that he was at university with had a band, or he was in a band, and he played bass, and they needed a drummer, and my brother said, "Oh, my brother's a really good drummer, but he's only 14. And I was allowed to go and play in this band because my brother's friend was my chaperone. So I used to go around and play. I played in this band for 2 years. We played three or four nights a week. It was amazing. We did a lot of work.
In club, in beer club, at 14.
In clubs, yeah. And you weren't allowed to drink till you were 21 at that time.
Yes.
But I was 14. I played in clubs and pubs and, you know, all sorts of stuff.
And did you have a lot of groupies at that moment?
I had one or two. I had one or two that when I was very young. Yes, it was one of the things I think that was probably a formative part of my psyche, I think. I didn't have to wait very long to have my first sexual experience, put it that way.
But you are sure that you played drums your whole life at that moment? Because I read you write song, you sing, you play guitar too.
Yeah, but I knew that was my instrument. That was something that I just did naturally. That was my natural instrument, you know. I've had to teach myself everything else, but drums, I basically taught. I didn't ever take a lesson. I just taught myself. It was just, I knew it was, as soon as I sat down at a drum kit, I had a groove, you know, and it was like, yep, I can dig this.
And always now, you are
always.
Now when you sit behind your drums, you are like in your bed.
Yeah, when I sit behind my drums, seriously, I feel like I'm about 14 years old and getting the same blast that I got from playing drums then. I get the same blast. I enjoy it.
Oh, I want to see you as 13.
Yeah. No, I really do. I was talking to somebody about it the other night, and I was just saying how lucky I am. But the thing that's a drag about it is going away from home and not being able to do all my other work, you know, because I'm driving around the place. But the actual hour and a half, or nearly 2 hours now, that I spend on stage a night is just pure fun.
You want to say you are playing in how many times?
Today. Sorry?
Today, Have you done
We're playing in, what is it, quarter to six. We'll go down and have dinner at 7 and we play at 10. So, you know, it's like another 4 hours' time before we play.
It means you are okay right now, or you must...
Yeah, well, but, you know, I've been, since I got into the hotel, which was about 2 hours ago, when we had to drive 3 hours from last night, I've done 2 hours of work on the computer, because you imagine putting together this concert and this whole foundation is basically a full-time job, but I really can't do anything else. So, you know, every kind of waking moment that I'm not on stage at the moment, I'm sort of working on that. Although I will have time just to maybe lie down on the bed for half an hour, for a power nap.
You hear me?
Oh, yes, I can hear you now. Yeah, I lost you just for a second. Are you there?
I need a sound engineer.
Yes.
Because you were sound engineer too.
Or yeah, I am. Are you there?
I want to know when you were sound engineer. Is what in parallel of musician, or it was a moment you did that?
Well, I learned how to be a sound engineer because I wanted to record my own stuff, and I wanted to be able to record other people. Mm-hmm. It was really from after I joined the Angels. Actually, if I go back when I was about 18. Yeah, 18, 17 or 18, I've had a tape recorder. I've always had a tape recorder and a way of recording stuff. So I've always been into, you know, recording the bands I was in or just recording stuff. And when I started recording with the Angels, we ended up at Albert's Records, Albert Studios, where they had three recording studios, and quite often we were just given months of time just to go in there and record stuff and you know, write songs and record. So I ended up with an opportunity to learn how to record and how to run a studio, how to work a mixing desk and all that sort of stuff, which I did, and I got to the point where I could go out and do, you know, make records for people as a producer, but also I could engineer them. So I did a lot of that, lots of records. Well, I'll see. Here's John. I'll see what's... Is Rick with us? Just 1 second. John thinks Rick's asleep. Okay, I'll put you on.
Hello?
Hello?
Oh.
Yeah.
Who's that?
John. Is John...
Oh. It's Annie.
Yes, Annie.
In Marseille.
Yes.
How you doing?
I'm fine.
I'd like to take you down a peg or two. What's the point in wasting time with you? You make me feel so small. You think you've got it all. But fuck all the elegant talk. Let's run. You know deep down you're just a piece of shit. You know it's true and you have to live with it. You think you've got it all, but I've got bigger bones. So fuck all the elegant talk. Let's rock. Change your stupid ways. It's crazy, but you'll always be the same. You choose to ignore the things I've said before. So fuck all the elegant.
After this cool song called Elegant Talk, written by David Minder in March 2006, the period where I did the interview with Buzz is funny, no? Now, the Angels in Perth in 1981, thanks to my French Angels connection. Stay connected with www.meltingpot.com. I will do soon interviews with Steve Tallis and John McNair, and surely soon with Buzz Bistrup and the Angels. Bye, tschüss, au revoir, à la prochaine fois.
Hello, this is Shane from Melbourne, Australia, and you're listening to Annie from Marseille on Melting Pot, the best radio show in the world.
Listen to the tone with the people with any wrong will say.